Hi, this is Mimi Sheraton, author of 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die, and you are listening to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm Carrie Diamond, editorial director of Cherry Bomb, the indie magazine about women and food. On today's show, we have two women making their mark on the food world in very different ways. Hawa Hassan of the indie brand Boss Boss and Molly Ye, the blogger and new cookbook author. This season of Radio Cherry Bomb is brought to you by Knopf, publisher of food's most fabulous icons, from Julia Child to Lydia Bastianich, and home to new literary talents, such as Sweet Bitter's Stephanie Dandler. Speaking of Stephanie, Cherry Bomb is coming to Chicago, yay, for a special Sweet Bitter event. On Tuesday, October 18th at 6 p.m., we're hosting a book reading, signing, and cocktail party at the Boarding House with Stephanie in celebration of her best-selling novel. Tickets are $75 and include a signed copy of the book, a copy of Cherry Bomb, great wine and hors d'oeuvres, and some sweet treats to take home from Vosges au Chocolat and Wild Ophelia. Check out our Instagram page for the ticket link. I read Stephanie's book this summer and really could not put it down. If you work in the restaurant world, it's a must read, as it's all about life as a server in one of New York's top restaurants. It's so beautifully written. Stephanie clearly has a long, bright career ahead of her. If you live in Chicago, come hang out with us. I'd love to see you. Our first guest wants more people to know about the foods of her native country, Somalia. She is the founder of Boss Boss, a line of Somali sauces sold in specialty shops like Dina DeLuca, and soon to launch in Whole Foods Market. Hawa participated in the incubator program at Hot Bread Kitchen in Harlem and has big plans to expand her small brand. Hawa was born in Mogadishu, the capital of Somalia, and by the time she was 5 years old, she was living in a UN refugee camp in Nairobi, Kenya, with her four siblings and her mother. Within 2 years, her mother had her own business and an apartment. But as the family moved out of the camp, her mother made the difficult decision to send Hawa to Seattle to live with a family friend. It would be 15 years before Hawa saw her family again. Her story is certainly one of perseverance and positivity, and she's an influence to all of us here at Cherry Bomb. Hawa Hassan, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thank you, Carrie. I'm so excited to be here.
We're so excited to have you here. So let's get right into it. Tell us how Boss Boss came to be.
I moved to New York at the end of 2005, and I came here to model. While doing that, I always knew that at some point the curtains would come down and I would need a game plan, an exit strategy. I always wanted to be in food, but for the most part, I wanted to do green juices and create a healthy lifestyle brand. And in 2014, I went to go see my mom, who lives in Oslo, and took my Vitamix and was blending every day. And my mom and I just got in conversation about young Somalis and people that are really changing the way that my siblings are coming up in Europe, that are influencing European culture, whether it's in the entrepreneurial space or if it's opening up restaurants. And my mom thought it would be a better idea if I did something along the lines of my home country as opposed to doing something a lot of other people were doing. My mom was really the force behind the sauces and wanting me to introduce Somali cuisine to America.
So it is not easy to get a business off the ground, especially when you're a one woman. I know your mother managed to do it, but it's hard. It's hard anywhere when you're a one woman operation. Where did you even begin?
I think that where I got my biggest kick and push from was when I legalized the company. I thought if I put money in now, then I'll have to follow through. That was a big Kickstarter. And then after that, just meeting the right people and being in conversation with women who are in that space. That's been very helpful for me. Hot Bread Kitchen has been instrumental in giving me the tools that I needed originally.
So let's talk about Hot Bread for a second. So a lot of you know about Hot Bread Kitchen. I think we've had Jessamine Rodriguez on the show, who's the founder.
Absolutely.
It's sort of a two-part organization. It's a bakery that works with lot of immigrant women. Yep. And it's also an incubator program. So you got into the incubator program?
Yeah. So I pretty much stalked Yezamen 2013 through 2014. And my biggest idea was, if I get into this kitchen, if she accepts me, then I will have all the resources I need. And so I applied January of 2015. Yezamen and I had a conference call. I was in Seattle. When I started the sauce, when I wanted to start the sauce, I moved to Seattle for 8 months just to focus on it. And she called me. We had a conversation and turned in my business plan and all these things that she'd asked for, and came back, and I hit the ground running. But the very first 6 months wouldn't have been possible without, you know, Yezamen and her team telling me, well, you need a schedule to process, you know, and allowing me to produce in a way that I can learn.
So let me ask you about the crucial but kind of nosy question. Where did you get the money to do a product line?
It's still tricky because I like to say that I had all this money. I didn't. So
you didn't make mad cash from your modeling career?
Well, even if I did, I spent so much money on not only taking care of myself, but being the eldest daughter in my family, my father living in Mogadishu still. You know, there are a lot of different responsibilities that maybe some of my friends don't have here in New York or in America. And so I never... Though I knew modeling was going to end, I never was somebody who just put money away or kept putting money away. I've definitely asked some of my best friends for money. I have a girlfriend named Rachel who's been instrumental, especially in the beginning. She was like, okay, your insurance is due. Let me help.
So are they official investors in your business?
No.
Or was that just sort of angel friend?
Angel friend. Angel friends, for sure. Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about what Boss Boss is exactly. Tell us what's in the line.
Right now, our first two offerings are a tamarind and date sauce and a coconut and cilantro sauce.
Sounds so good.
Yeah, they're pretty yummy. And they're the national condiments of Somalia. And so for me, I really would love for this to be a household thing, the same way that sriracha and ketchup are. And that's my big picture, is having them at every table, inside every refrigerator. I think people are using food as a passport and a gateway into other cultures, especially the millennials. You know, we're not making money, so we're not traveling as much, but we have a very diverse palate. I think I just called myself a millennial. That's fine.
That's fine. I mean, are you a millennial? It's fine as long as you are a millennial.
I think so.
If I call myself a millennial, I might get called out on that. But it's Fashion Week in Paris right now. So mm-hmm. Let's talk about modeling a tiny bit. What kind of modeling did you do?
In the beginning, I did some runway. Mm-hmm. When I moved to New York, I did a lot more catalog and commercial work. And
did you enjoy it?
I did. I am not a, I thought about it over the years, like why some of my friends were widely successful and maybe what wasn't working for me was that I didn't know how to turn it on and turn it off. I'm pretty much the same person from, you know, work to home. Mm-hmm. And, I think that didn't help me much, that I couldn't turn it on and turn it off with clients or at set. But I did very well, and I learned so much from modeling, especially being in business now.
Yeah, I was going to say, a lot that you have been able to put toward your new entrepreneur life.
Absolutely. Just even being able to leverage relationships that I built during my short-lived career. Friends that know people at Whole Foods, or friends that that have other friends that are in food, that I worked with in a random, you know, random way, I guess.
So where is home for you now? You mentioned Mogadishu, you mentioned your mom in Oslo,
yep.
Right? You've got New York, you've got Seattle.
I always say that home for me is where my mother is, so... She goes between Mombasa, which is in Kenya, and in Oslo. So I try to go to Oslo once a year and then hopefully try to meet up once in Kenya.
And where are your siblings today?
Some of them are in boarding school in Kenya, and then the rest are in Oslo.
And you were the oldest of the five?
There's 10 of us now.
Oh, there are 10 of you. Wow. Okay.
My mom remarried and have five more with her second husband. I'm the second eldest.
Wow. Okay. That is a big, it's a lot of people to remember for birthdays and holidays and whatnot. So let's talk about your childhood, because it's really an astonishing story. What do you remember from living in a refugee camp?
I remember people being really happy. Mm-hmm. I remember people sharing a lot, whether it was like talk about what was going to be next for our government, people sharing food. I just remember folks starting anew, you know, turning. It was a time of change for not just a few people, but a whole country. So you can imagine how that is, like a huge, an uprising or a new day. So I just remember people gathering all the time, in conversation all the time, folks coming over for dinner every night, because it wasn't like you weren't going to get up and go to work the next day, at least not that first year.
And then when your mother made the decision to send you to America, you were only 7 years old, mm-hmm. right? How was that news communicated to you, and what do you remember?
Well, originally another woman who lived in our camp, her daughter was supposed to go to Seattle with a group of Somali refugees, and my mother had applied for sponsorship. So she thought, one less kid, I'll only have four, it'll be easier to get to America, we'll be right behind her. That didn't happen. She didn't get sponsorship until 2001, and that was to Norway. So I was told, you're going to go with this group of people. I knew a few of them. I was a very adventurous kid. I was like my mom's sidekick. So for me, anything to make things easier at that point on her. And that was it. I mean, it came about 1 month and I was gone the next.
You say you were your mom's sidekick. Did you think you would be reunited quickly?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think the first 2 years I wore my hijab. I like prayed every day. I was like, I'm going to make my mother proud. You know, she's going to show up and I'm going to be fluent in English. And then by the time I was like, third year of like going back to school, I was like, okay, no one's coming.
And how were you able to communicate with them?
Oh yeah, my mom wrote a lot of letters. She called once a month, twice, mm-hmm. you know, or every other week or so. Whenever she could, she'd call. She'd always send me gifts. Anytime someone new was coming to town, they had something for me. I felt very loved. It just was something that needed to be done, I guess, at the time.
Yeah. How do you think that shaped how you are as an adult now?
I think I'm really cautious about things, but I'm also very optimistic about life. And I think when you're 7 years old and you have to navigate new waters, it really brings about new things in you. I went to Seattle as a little girl who was, you know, I'd never really been out of my mother's sight or my father's or my siblings for that matter. And so to be by myself all over again, was really interesting, but there's no place on earth I can't go now and fit right in. And I think that in itself is a gift that came from this journey.
Was Seattle welcoming?
Absolutely. By the time I was in middle school, I joined like Young Life. Do you know Young Life, the Christian group? I joined Young Life. I joined 4-H. I had basketball teammates who took me in and like fed me, you know, on Sunday nights. Seattle was very welcoming.
So I would imagine you have maybe strong feelings about the current refugee situation.
I do. As a nation and as a United Nations, like, everybody, I think we're absolutely failing in protecting the refugees all over the world. I'm still a green card holder. I'm not a U.S. citizen. And so even sometimes when I travel, I see the way that I'm treated with my U.S. travel document. It's under a refugee asylum. It's a green card, a green passport that I use. So I don't know what the answers are, but I think people need to open their borders. I think people need to be welcoming from the ground up, neighbors. I recently heard about the people in Idaho protesting because Hamdi from Jobani is like heavily funding the refugees that are coming over. So I hope things change.
They need to open their borders and open their minds, I think.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's the first step.
Would you like to be a citizen?
Yeah. I think it would make me moving around a little bit easier.
I would imagine.
Yeah.
I would imagine. So let's talk about Somali cuisine.
Okay.
So many people lump, they just say African cuisine.
Ethiopians have made a huge wave in America when it comes to making their cuisine available to more people. So and you could talk to any friend of yours and they'll be like, oh yeah, you say, have you had African food? They'll say, I had Ethiopian mm-hmm. food. But African food is different depending on the country. So if you're a landlocked country, obviously you're not going to have access to fish the same way that a country like Senegal does. So you can imagine that Somalia is very different from Ethiopian cuisine. Ethiopians, ours is sweet and savory, and it's a lot of rice. It's heavily Italian influenced because we were colonized by the Italians until 1960. We eat our anjeras different. We eat ours in the morning for breakfast with tea and cinnamon and butter.
Tell us what anjeras are.
Anjera is it's a flat bread, a thin, thin flat bread. So it would be kind of the way that most people use tortilla. But Ethiopians use theirs on every meal, so they use it as a bed on most of their food. So we don't do that. We eat it at breakfast. We eat rice. We eat pasta. We eat banana with everything, as I've told you before.
Yeah, let's talk about that. You gave me the recipe for a beautiful stew. Mm-hmm. That pronounce it for me again, because
it's just Somali chicken stew.
Somali chicken stew. Mm-hmm. I could pronounce that. but there's a name. What's the official name for it?
Sugo.
And you said it's served with banana on the side, which
right.
I thought was fascinating. And it's so beautiful and so fragrant. My apartment smelled amazing for days. And you said it's something that's passed down from woman to woman.
Yeah. So in my family, it's passed down from my grandmother to my mother and then to my sisters and I. It's comforting. It's a reminder of home. It's something that we make for guests when they come over. It's just like a small token of a welcome. So I love to make it. I make it weekly. I love to make it for company. I make it for anyone I love, actually.
Now, you said the two sauces that are in the Basbas line are sort of the national condiments of Somalia. So how do you use those? Like, if I bought them in Whole Foods, how would I use them?
You could use them the same way you use sriracha as an additive, or you can use it to sear your fish, your chicken, especially our red one, the tamarind and date sauce. Or you could use it as a dip on top of hard-boiled eggs. It's really up to you. It's, you know, it's multi-purpose.
And you have some recipes on your website, right?
I do, yeah.
Are they your recipes? Friends? Where are they from?
No, these are recipes that other people have done but included my sauces. Again, being a one-woman show, there's no way I can conquer it all. But I hope to get more into creating my own and getting creative in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm. So where is there a great Somali restaurant in New York?
Yes.
Where do we all need to go?
The only one, actually. My girlfriend Muna opened up a restaurant on 116th Street, and it's in Little Senegal. It's just right there in the middle, I think between 6th and 7th.
What's the name of it?
It's called Safari.
Safari. Okay,
yeah.
We all have to, we maybe have to organize a cherry bomb outing.
Absolutely.
To Safari.
You would love it. You won't regret anything on that menu.
Oh, that'll be a blast. And she's the chef or the owner, both?
Her and her husband are the chefs together. Her husband does much more of the cooking, but she runs the front of the house. He runs the back of the house.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, we're really excited to go there.
Yeah.
So, all right, it is time for the speed round. Are you ready?
As ready as I'll ever be.
Okay, coffee or tea?
Somali tea, shah, with cinnamon and cloves and cardamom.
Beautiful. Sweet or salty?
Salty.
What's in your fridge right now?
tomatoes, pepper, eggs, and kombucha.
What kitchen tool do you use the most?
My Vitamix.
If you were trapped on a desert island with one food celebrity, who would it be?
Oh, this is tough.
Speed round, first person who comes to mind.
Martha.
Why Martha?
I think she's really funny. She has a great sense of humor. And she seems very easy to get on with.
What are you reading currently?
I am reading Habits of Highly Effective People.
Good one. Where would you like to travel to next?
I would love to go to Cape Town.
Great. Well, Hawa, thank you so much for coming on the show today. I know we'll be talking to you a lot over the years. I hope the next time we see you, you have employees, right? Because now you are just a one-woman operation. But we're super excited about your brand, and we really look forward to seeing how Boss Boss expands. And that's great news about Whole Foods, because that's a new development, right?
Yes.
That you'll be in Whole Foods soon. So everyone should look for Boss Boss in a store near you or on bossbosssauce.com. You can also ask your favorite retailer if they carry the sauce. We will be right back with Molly A. after this message from our sponsor. Imagine the culinary world without the influence of Julia Child, Marcella Hazan, Edna Lewis, Maher Joffrey, Lydia Bastianich, and Judith Jones. It's impossible. We have the iconic publishing house Knopf to thank for bringing the writings and the recipes of these women to life. Knopf's great tradition of supporting new voices continues today with Smitten Kitchen's Deb Perlman, Sweet Bitter's Stephanie Dandler, and Butter Baked Good's Rosie Dakin. Check out Knopf's great collection of fiction, nonfiction, and cookbooks at your favorite bookstore. Keep reading and keep cooking with Knopf. Our next guest is one of the most loved food bloggers around, Molly Ye. She launched her popular website, My Name is Ye, and quickly found an audience for her fusion-friendly recipes and storytelling. She was raised in the Chicago suburbs. Is that right, Molly? I
forgot
to fact-check
that
with you. Studied percussion at Juilliard in Manhattan and now lives on a farm on the Minnesota-North Dakota border. Is that right?
Correct. Yes.
She can now add author to her resume, as her first cookbook, Molly on the Range, was just published. Molly Ye, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thank you so much. It's crazy to be here because I listen to it all the time in my little kitchen, and the theme song echoes through my kitchen, and it's so weird to hear the real thing right here.
Well, what's so weird to me is it took us so long to get you on Radio Cherry Bomb.
Oh,
I forget what season we're in now. Who knows? But we've known you for a lot. We've known you, as you know, internet friends, for a long time.
Yeah. I think it was Gabby that interviewed me as a Cherry Bomb It Girl
right.
in 2014.
Was that the very first issue?
I want to say it was the second issue.
Oh, Erin McKenna on the cover?
I think so,
Not that I expect you to remember all of that. But Gabby Vigoro, who we love. Hi, Gabby.
Hi, Gabby.
She usually listens. And then I went to Yahoo Food and was with my whole team there, and you were our blogger of the year.
That was crazy. I still remember finding out about that. I was on my mini moon in Duluth, Minnesota, outside of Duluth. So I actually had no phone service at all, except for this one little patch. And suddenly my phone started literally exploding, and people were like, you're Yahoo's food blogger of the year. They were like, they compared you to Mario Batali. And I started crying right in the middle of my mini moon.
That was pretty funny. We loved doing those awards. We were like, let's do, because Yahoo Food was like a new thing. We were like, let's do awards. Molly Yeh will be our blogger of the year. And you know what was really fun? We named Amy Chaplin's cookbook. She has a beautiful vegan cookbook called At Home in the Whole Foods Kitchen.
Yeah.
And it's such a beautiful book. Even if you're not a vegan, it's so beautiful.
Gorgeous.
So we named that. We kind of went out on a limb and named that because the Yahoo audience wasn't exactly the vegan, audience. So we named that our cookbook of the year. And the book went from number on Amazon to number 22 of all books overall. So literally every 5 minutes we were checking her ranking. And it was like we were her mother. We were so excited. Aww. We were high-fiving every time. So it's nice when you can do nice things like that.
Yeah, that's awesome.
But it's taken us this long to meet.
That's crazy. We were supposed to meet in March. At South By.
Oh, right. Oh, and then Yahoo Food was no more. Oh, wait, we were... That's right.
We were on the phone. We talked on the phone.
We had big plans.
We did.
We had big plans. Yeah. I'm sorry about that. Yeah, that was a little out of my control, as you can imagine.
So. Oh, yeah.
But now we're here, and you are a cookbook author.
That's weird.
Tell us...
That's crazy.
Because your writing comes naturally to you, and cooking, and recipe testing, and taking pictures and food styling. How different is the process of doing a cookbook versus doing a blog?
So with the blog, I can really just be in control. And if I feel like putting something off, I can put it off. And if I don't get to that one task that was on my to-do list for the past 3 months, I can eventually just kind of eliminate it and pretend like it never existed. But with the book, it was just such a intense process of not leaving any page unturned, getting to everything, people following up until you respond to their email. It's huge project, and I feel like I'm so bad at quitting big projects that to now have a hardcover book in front of me that I made is like giving birth to a book baby. Not that I know what giving birth is like, but it's fun. And I've always kept diaries and I've always kept scrapbooks and they're always really kind of rustic with scotch tape, putting the pictures onto the page with my Sharpie markers in my little, kid scrapbooks. And so now to have something that's an actual real legit book in print that people can pay money for and give us gifts and stain with all of their ingredients and stuff is so exciting.
Yeah, is it thrilling to have something tangible when your whole life is online?
Absolutely. And that was something that was a little bit difficult for me when I migrated my personal diary practice to the blog. It was a switch in a mindset to go from having my little Moleskine diary that I would take in my little carry-on bag anytime I would go anywhere and just journal the day away, to going to something that, on one hand, it's great that I can share it with other people, and my family and stuff can read it. But on the other hand, it was a little bit nerve-wracking to know that I don't have this one, physical object that I can carry around and protect, and who knows, what if the internet blows up and my blog is gone? That's my baby, that's my diary. And so it's it was a little bit uneasy for me to make that transition, but now I have a physical book. So,
and you obviously wrote everything. All the recipes are yours. Did you do all the pictures and the food styling?
I did a large majority of the pictures. There are some pictures in there that we shot for events like a harvest party. There's a bonfire. There's a farm lunch and a pizza night on a tractor. And so for that, I had my good friend Chantel, who's an amazing photographer in Fargo, come to Grand Forks to do that. And she was my wedding photographer, too. And I think the world of her. And so she took those lifestyle shots.
So for those who don't know your blog, my name is Yeh. Tell us about the blog.
So the blog began as just an extension of my diary. It started 7 years ago, and I would blog about the silliest things, like my Halloween costumes or just like random photo shoots with large stacks of cans of Red Bulls that I had just drinking. It was just so, very collegey and very I would put like photos from those disposable cameras up on the blog, or I would do Polaroid photos, and it's like kind of embarrassing. Promise me you won't go back into the archives and look. But as I sort of grew up and explored the city outside of Lincoln Center where I was going to school and learned about restaurants and learned about different foods from all over the world, I took notice that I was blogging more and more about food, and more people started reading it when I started blogging about food, and I loved it so much. I would leave the practice room early. I would stop practicing my xylophone so that I can go and try a Minetta Tavern Black Label burger and spend all of my work study money on that. And then I remember after that night, I walked back. It was like a 5-mile walk through Manhattan back up to my apartment. And the entire way I was just dreaming of how I could write about it and how I could talk about it and like tell my few 5 readers about it. And I just got so excited about food. And when I left the dorms and when I moved into an apartment, I realized how fulfilling and how fun it was to make food myself and not necessarily go out to restaurants all the time. And it was, I think one of the things that I was really appealed to was the fact that in music, you're always playing other people's music, and or at least I was. I can't write music. But I was always going to the practice room and trying to get myself to play a piece of music that somebody else had written, and I didn't really have that much control over the over that side of the creative process. And so learning how to make food and feel like I could have the control from gathering my ingredients to developing the recipe to taking the photos and then writing about it was so fulfilling to me. So I... it morphed into a recipe blog when I was in Manhattan and Brooklyn. And then when I moved out to the farm, all this new content sort of opened up because there were so many new foods that I had, they even in Manhattan couldn't get, like Midwestern cookie salad and Jell-O salad and hot dish and these very comforting, hearty foods that are so good for like the North, the Upper Midwest. And so that's what I blog about now, in addition to recipes that are inspired by my heritage, my Chinese and Jewish heritage, because I'm the only Chinese Jew in town. So if I'm not going to make challah and scallion pancakes, not many other people are. So so it's the kind of the exchange of cultures there.
Yeah, let's talk about your family. So I'm guessing, were you unique in your Chicago suburb?
No, not at all. My suburb had, there was a large Jewish community, a large Asian community, and so I never felt the kind of sticking outness that I do now in my sea of Scandinavian community members. But
and that was the land of John Hughes, 16 Candles,
yes,
and
yeah,
Pretty in Pink, and all that.
I just started reading Jason Diamond's book about John Hughes.
You were the other Molly.
Yeah. Yeah, John Hughes went to the other high school in my district, so it's definitely that world.
Were those movies impactful on you growing up? Or were you not that generation?
It was a little bit after that generation.
I know, I'm older.
Sorry.
They were big for me, but okay, we'll move on. So who's Jewish and who's Chinese in
your
family?
My mother's Jewish and my dad's Chinese.
And how did they find each other in this world?
My dad dropped a plate of food at her feet at a party that she was not going to go to. Apparently she was like ready for bed and her friend called her. They were living in my dad lives in Chicago, or they both live in Chicago, but, my dad is in the Chicago Symphony and my mom was in grad school at the time. And she was like ready for bed. And then her friend called her and said, we're going to this holiday party. And she showed up and my dad dropped a plate of food at her feet. And that was that.
And who was the cook in the family?
My mom was a cook. My dad is like a insane eater. He is a human garbage disposal. He does not let any leftovers go to waste. Every restaurant we leave, he has a doggy bag. Yeah.
Do you have siblings?
I do. I have an older sister who, she actually went to culinary school and studied pastry, and she is now in the wine industry. And I have a younger half-sister who is 10 who loves baking cakes. I'm so proud of her. And she loves food. She'll eat everything. She corrected my pronunciation of the word seitan the other day. Couldn't believe it. She's amazing.
Did you cook growing up?
I baked. I woke up pretty much every Sunday to like fresh baked scones and fresh coffee cakes because my mom loves to bake. And every night during the week we would have fresh home cooked dinners, except for on Friday pizza night. That was her break. So I occasionally would go and help her out, and it was a lot of fun. Learned a lot.
How did your fusion approach to cooking come about? Was that something your mom was doing, or did you just sort of create that on your own?
My mom has always really encouraged me to just like basically make whatever I want and to not buy Oreos. She has like this funny line, like when we go to the store, if I wanted to buy Oreos, she'd be like, well, why would you buy them when we can make them from scratch? And she just loves making things herself instead of buying them already made. And so she's always just really encouraged me to not really like color within the lines. Like I never had coloring books. I had blank pieces of paper to draw on and draw my own thing. And so she always encouraged me to expand the meaning of the word dumpling. Every year we have our Dumplings of the World Christmas party, and we don't have to stick to the traditional like physical appearance of a dumpling. Like if we want to fry something, if we want to do like arancini, like we consider that a dumpling in our dumpling party. So it's she loves encouraging me to be creative, and that definitely all comes from her.
I'm looking for some examples of your sort of culinary mashups in here. What would you say? I'm flipping through Molly's cookbook right now. What would you say some of your more famous mashups are?
The scallion pancake challah really kind of took off, and a lot of people have tagged me on Instagrams that they've made it. I would say that's definitely like the number one, because it's basically like me as a bread.
And for the cookbook, are all the recipes new?
No, a few of them are sort of updated versions of recipes that have been on my blog. So there's a new funfetti cake, the scallion pancake challah is there, Asian scotch eggs are there that I did for Food 52 a while back. And so they were a lot of things that I sort of just updated and tested a million more times for the book.
That's super nice, because I'm sure there are some things from the early days where you're like, oh, I'd love to erase that post.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And
I have a no erasing blog posts policy. So it's all there, folks.
When did blogging become a profession for you?
Blogging became a profession when I moved out to Grand Forks. And I was working at a bakery, kind of part-time. And aside from that, though, my husband, Nick, was working in the fields very, very long days, and I hadn't made any friends yet. So it was kind of like I didn't really have anything else to do, and I just threw myself into the blog, and I worked on my photos. And I think that once I started figuring things out about photos and lighting and once I started figuring out Pinterest is when I started driving more traffic to the blog. And that's how I was able to get more opportunities to contribute to other sites, take on sponsored posts for my site, and start to monetize the blog.
And you learned all of this on your own?
I definitely had mentors that I would sort of just really glob onto and ask them questions about photography. I read a lot about photography. I spoke to a bunch of other bloggers about the business side of things. It was a lot of talking to people. Mm-hmm. and then just a lot of locking myself into a room and working until I started to figure things out.
I was just at the Sever blogger luncheon other day, and you were their blogger of the year last year.
Yeah.
And yeah, it seems like a lot of the questions are about how do you make a living as a blogger?
Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's a really good time for bloggers right now, because a lot of companies do see that as a really great, fun, creative way to access their audience and customer base. And bloggers have a ton of fun with it too, like working with various different products. Sorry.
We're pouring water here. We're just hanging out. We're semi-live.
Well, I mean, like, as a blogger, you're you have to work on different skills, such as the photography and the recipe development and the writing and social media. And a lot of those skills are transferable to different, different jobs. So, a blogger might not necessarily be monetizing their actual blog, but using their photography skills to take photos for various different brands with different food products, or to do recipe development for larger sites and companies. And so it's just a lot of like transferable skills that as a blogger, you really have to have in tip-top shape.
So social media is just, I mean, everyone's so obsessed now, whether it's Snapchat or Instagram stories. How has that hurt or helped blogs?
It's definitely changed it. It's revolutionized it. And I think people are going to blogs for different things now than they once did. When I first started the blog, I could do a blog post that was one photo and a few lines of how my day was. Now that goes on Instagram. And people are figuring out that audiences would rather be looking at photos on Instagram. They'd rather be looking at videos on maybe Facebook or Snapchat or Instagram stories. So there are less reasons to go to a blog, but I think one of the reasons that remains is the writing. We haven't really figured out the Instagram of writing yet, and who knows if we ever will. But I think that that blogs with the type of writing that people want to read are the ones that are still doing really well today. Grace Bonney gave an amazing talk this morning at the Better Homes and Gardens Style Maker Conference. She gave the keynote speech, and she compared the future of blogging or a blog in the future to it's going to be like the living room in a house. And people might choose to only go and hang out in the kitchen, which could be, you know, one of the social networks, and or they might go to any one of the other rooms. But the blog is, Grace sees it as still being like the hub of a site or a personality or a brand. But more and more people are choosing to hang out in the kitchen with the snacks.
Okay. Well, the blog of the future.
Yeah.
So we have so many things we could talk to Molly about. We didn't even, I'm music obsessed. We didn't even get to scratch the surface on music. Molly is a percussionist, a trained percussionist. And you performed with the Los Angeles Opera not too long ago.
Yeah.
I mean, who knew? That's amazing.
it's so much fun, especially because musicians love food and they're always down to go try new restaurants after the show. So I love it. I don't play as much as I did when I lived in New York, just because there aren't that many opportunities in North Dakota or northern Minnesota. But I have been able to travel, and I played at the LA Opera last year, and that recording is actually also out this month. It's this opera called Dog Days, which is this really bloody, post-apocalyptic, dark situation that has the most incredible music.
It sounds very you, dark, apocalyptic. All right. Well, we have to jump to the speed round, sadly, because we are running out of time. And Molly kind of cheated. She heard the question, so your answers better be really good. Okay, coffee or tea?
Black coffee before noon, green tea afternoon.
Sweet or salty?
Salty. Lots and lots and lots of salt and hot sauce.
Even though you're the queen of funfetti cakes.
Even though I'm the queen of funfetti cakes, I will take a pile of cheese fries over a cake any day.
What's in your fridge?
6 different types of tahini, eggs, a lot of butter, and some like random experiments and like containers that I'm sure are not going to be cleaned out until I get home next week. Sorry, Nick.
What kitchen tool do you use the most?
Rubber spatulas all the way. They are like the best for getting cake batter off the bowl and licking it.
If you were trapped on a desert island with one food celebrity, who would it be?
Michael Solomonov, so that he can make me hummus all day.
What are you reading?
Jason Diamond's book on John Hughes.
Which I will pick up. Amazing. I didn't even know that book was out.
I don't know. We traded like pre-release copies, mm-hmm. So I don't know if it is out. I know that it's coming out this fall. And He was a cupcake bouncer at Magnolia. Not John Hughes. Jason Diamond was. And oh my gosh.
Oh wait, Jason Diamond's like spelled like my last name?
Yes.
Oh, I think we like talk to each other on Twitter every now and then.
He's a great tweeter.
Okay.
Yeah.
I need to, we're not related, but I'll find
You've
got to
get the book. Yeah.
Okay. And I just had an idea. I've been dying to have Molly Ringwald in the magazine. You should interview Molly Ringwald for us.
Molly and Molly.
That would be fun.
For sure.
All right. Where would you like to travel to next?
Oh, the mountains. Anywhere with mountains. I love mountains. And where I live is as flat as can possibly be. And it's great for getting work done. And it is very relaxing. But I also love just going up into the mountains and maybe when it's snowy and sit by a fire and eat fondue or something.
That sounds fabulous. Well, Molly's new book is out right now, Molly on the Range. Make sure you pick it up. It's fantastic. It's a great read, too.
Thank you.
Even if you're not, you know, cooking, it's a really fun book to read through. Everything's beautiful about it. So congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for finally coming on the show.
So nice to finally meet you.
What a thrill. And please, anytime you're back in New York, open invitation to talk to us some more. So that's it for today's show. It was a pleasure speaking with Hawa and Molly today. Thanks, as always, to our engineer, Dave Tadashore, and much love to Knopf for supporting this season of Radio Cherry Bomb and for publishing such beautiful books. Don't forget to support Heritage Radio, the not-for-profit home of Radio Cherry Bomb. To make a donation, visit heritageradionetwork.org. Thank you for listening, everyone. You're the bomb.
This is Charlotte Druckman. I'm a food writer in New York City, and I've just written the cookbook Stir, Sizzle, Bake about baking in a cast iron skillet. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and the Heritage Radio Network. To subscribe or learn more about the magazine, visit cherrybomb.com. You know who I think is the bomb? Kim Severson of the New York Times. She's the journalist who writes about food who I probably most admire and whose stories I most look forward to reading every week. She writes beautifully about people, places, and the cooking of both. She covers the politics of food with such a dry sense of humor that you almost forget you're reading about politics until the end, when you walk away with a very clear sense of what's at stake and who's responsible. She's written two books, a memoir called Spoonfed and a cookbook called Cookfight with Julia Moskin, who's another food writer you should know about. You can read them both online and in print at the New York Times, if you aren't already, which makes no sense.